18. The next morning, when it was time to go to the summit's second day of meetings, Britt the Younger was feeling edgy. Three attempts on your life will do that to you. Having Britt the Elder predict a fourth attempt didn't help. Martin, Philip, and Gwen were nervous as well. They gathered at Britt the Younger's apartment and escorted her to the summit. They considered just teleporting to the convention center, but Britt didn't want to look like she was living in fear, so they walked. Gwen walked in front, looking for anything out of the ordinary. Martin and Philip walked on either side of Britt, ready to leap into action the instant anything went wrong. Three guards, one of whom was Ampix, still wearing his new hat, brought up the rear. As long as Britt the Elder seemed unconcerned, this was all the official response the situation was likely to get. And like all obvious precautions, none of this did anything to help Britt relax or make her look less fearful. Martin tried to reassure her.
If Philip's right and she's not really you, maybe Britt the Elder's memory of today is wrong.
You mean her memory that someone would try to kill me and fail?
Britt asked.
Yeah,
Martin said.
Well, Britt said, if her memory is wrong, then it may be that nobody tries to kill me today.
Martin said,
exactly,
Britt said.
Or she could be right about the attempt to kill me, but wrong about it being unsuccessful.
Oh, I hadn't thought of that,
Martin said.
Philip said, maybe she was predicting your failed attempt to cheer Britt up.
Martin looked back over his shoulder and found Ampix was staring at him. He asked the guard,
what are you looking at?
You.
Martin said,
yeah, I thought so,
and turned back around. They reached the lift station just before the lift departed on its trip down the wall of the city toward the center. There were few people on the lift platform already, but to Martin's chagrin, Gilbert and Sid, the angry fops, were two of them. They were wearing stifling three-piece suits with stiff, starched collars, top hats, walking sticks, and white gloves. They regarded Martin and Philip with equal parts amusement and loathing, much as one would look at a cockroach dressed as a clown. Martin ignored them. Philip hadn't dealt with them yet, and as was his way, met their scorn with attempted friendliness. Philip said,
good morning,
and bowed slightly. The shorter of the two men, the one with the waxed mustache, lifted his top hat and bowed in an extravagant manner.
Good morning, Philip. It is so good to see you. Martin, Gwen, Britt, lovely to see you today as well. I take it the purpose of traveling in this tight formation is to protect fair Britt in case another statue falls on her.
Philip said,
yes, you disapprove?
His veneer of friendliness was already wearing thin. Sid, the taller, chin-bearded one who had been silent until this point, said,
no, not at all. If you choose to spend your time making sure nobody kills someone who is unkillable, who are we to judge? Besides, this way, if another statue comes down, maybe it'll take you two out instead. Then we can step in and give the ladies some real protection.
Yes, ladies,
Gilbert agreed, raising his walking stick, which was piano black with ivory caps on both ends. He used the stick to tap Philip's wizard staff as he said,
theirs might be larger, but I promise we're better at using ours.
Martin grimaced in utter disgust.
Really? Making the obvious joke?
Any question in his mind as to why he and these two men didn't get along was now answered.
The first rule of using magic staffs and wands is that you never make the obvious joke.
That's your rule, not ours,
Gilbert said. Gwen decided it was time to speak up.
Tell me, has any woman ever laughed when you made the obvious joke?
No,
Sid said.
But that's just because women don't really have a sense of humor.
Gwen asked,
what makes you say that?
Sid said,
I tell a lot of jokes. Jokes my male friends think are hilarious. But women almost never laugh.
Britt nodded and said,
well, we can't argue with that. Your logic is as strong as your wit.
Sid bowed more deeply and said,
thank you.
Mercifully, the lift reached the lowest station, and it was time to disembark. Soon, Gilbert and Sid were lost in the crowd. The walkway was crowded with Atlanteans going about their business, and delegates all milling around before the summit commenced for the day. Gwen had expected to have to lead the rest of the group through the crowd, but word had gotten out about the two statues that had fallen on Brit, and everybody seemed to be giving their group plenty of room. They were nearly to the convention center's entrance when a voice rang out through the crowd.
Brit! Brit!
The crowd parted, and Ida, the duly elected president of Atlantis, ran through, followed closely by her towering servant. The president ran to Brit the Younger and hugged her tightly.
Oh, Brit, are you okay? I heard about the statues. I know you weren't hurt, but are you all right?
Yes, Brit said. I'm fine, Ida. Thanks for asking.
Ida released the hug, but held Brit at arm's length, studying her face.
Are you sure you're okay? I know how badly an accident like that can shake someone up. Having a statue fall on you once would be bad enough, but twice? What are the chances?
Brit said.
It's impossible, Ida. It wasn't an accident.
Ida smiled and shook her head.
Brit, I admit it's weird, but you can't think that it was anything but an accident. I mean, why on earth would anybody try to hurt you?
Brit opened her mouth to answer, but was interrupted by a whizzing noise and a razor-sharp arrow streaked into view at high speed, striking her harmlessly on the forehead. Brit grimaced and said,
I don't know, but I'm already getting pretty tired of it.
Philip, Gwen, and Martin all looked frantically around, trying to see who shot the arrow. Luckily, a random bystander in the crowd shrieked,
It came from up there!
The bystander pointed to the roof of a building near the rim of the city. All eyes turned and saw a single person looking down from the roof. From that distance, it was impossible to tell who the person was, but they could clearly tell that the entire crowd was looking at them, because the head quickly disappeared. Philip turned to Martin and saw empty space, a pair of feet, and a silver sequined hem streaking out of his vision. Martin had muttered,
Floogie,
under his breath, and was speeding toward the would-be assassin's position at top speed. Philip said,
There he goes.
Yep,
Gwen agreed. Ampix looked at them, then shielded his eyes to watch Martin's progress. Martin kept his eyes on the distant rooftop where he'd last seen the assailant. The rushing wind blowing directly in his face made it uncomfortable. For about the 100th time, Martin made a mental note to try to program some sort of auto-deploying goggles into the shell. Martin reached the top of the building and performed a perfect 3-point Iron Man landing, with his staff held behind and above him, designed to instill fear in the person he was pursuing. And it certainly would have, if anyone had been there to see it. Martin surveyed the roof. Like all of the other roofs in Atlantis, this one was made of a thick, milky crystalline material. In the far corner, there was a shed-like rectangular protrusion with a door. Martin ran to it, opening it cautiously, in case his prey was waiting to ambush him. The area inside the door was clear, so Martin entered. As his eyes adjusted to the lower indoor light, Martin saw that the door led to a long stairwell, much as you'd find in any high-rise building, except that it was a graceful curving spiral and made of milky glass. Martin heard the sound of someone running down the stairs very fast. He peered down the shaft of the stairwell and yelled, Hey! The running stopped, and a person's head emerged into the shaft almost a third of the way down. He thought it was the same head as he had seen on the roof, but now he was much closer, and Martin could see the look of absolute terror on the man's face. The head disappeared as quickly as it had appeared, and the running noises resumed at a faster pace than before. Martin knew that if the other man reached the bottom floor before him, he'd be lost. Martin also knew that he wouldn't catch up on foot. The other man had too much of a head start. The open shaft in the center of the spiral was just a little too tight to fly down at any speed without crashing. He briefly considered trying to fly down the spiral. He would catch up to the guy that way, but by the time he did, he'd likely be too dizzy to do anything but throw up on him. Martin smiled and reached into his pocket. He pulled his beanbag out and simply dropped it down the center of the shaft. Martin watched it plummet silently, then hit the floor at the bottom of the shaft with an echoing thud. Martin said, "Bamf." And instantly he was standing at the bottom of the shaft. He looked up through the spiral. The now more distant running noises stopped again, and again the man making them stopped running and peeked into the shaft. He looked up first, then turned and looked down. Martin smiled and waved up at the man.
"That's right," Martin thought. "I've got you, and we both know it."
The man looked stricken. His head disappeared again. Then Martin heard the unmistakable sound of rushed footsteps and a door opening and closing. Then the stairwell was silent, except for the sound of Martin cursing. Martin burst through the first door he saw, which led to an irregularly shaped hallway with three more doors. Martin tried one and found a dirty old mop. He tried the second and found a supply of clean new mops. The third door led to another hallway, this one tastefully decorated and ending in a bend rather than a door. Martin ran down the hall, rounded the corner, and stopped, momentarily flummoxed by what he saw. Despite being placed in a time before the beginning of recorded history, Martin was not particularly surprised to find seemingly modern scenes here in Atlantis. Also, even though he had never gone to a spa in his life, Martin was savvy enough to recognize one when he saw it. The air was a heady mix of soothing music and the smell of lavender, as you would expect. Employees were busy giving massages, pruning finger and toenails, and tweezing unwanted hairs. What surprised Martin was that all of the customers were big, beefy dudes. The man nearest to Martin was sitting back with a hot towel on his face, while another man gave him a foot massage. The man receiving the foot rub was talking listlessly while the man giving the foot rub pretended to listen.
"Yeah, I've always been a natural athlete. I'm good with the javelin, but my real forte is the discus. Ladies love a man who can throw a good discus, and the ones who aren't ladies love it even more. It's that pose at the beginning. Well, there's nothing manlier than that."
At the end of the room, Martin could see an open door. A man was walking in to get some part of his body tended to, and Martin saw broad daylight behind him. Martin shouted, "Hold the door!" Then he took off flying at top speed, but at an altitude of about 4 feet. Martin smiled when he heard men shouting, things falling, and water splashing as he shot through the spa. Martin emerged back into the outside world. He angled up at a 45-degree angle to get some distance from the chaos he had just created. He circled around back to face the wall of the city and saw that the building he had just left stood out a good distance from the upper curve of the wall. It had several entrances at its base, at the front of the building, and other entrances onto the street behind the building about halfway up. He estimated that the man who'd fired the arrow was about half of the way down the tower when he exited, so Martin gained altitude and searched for anything that might tell him which direction the guy he was chasing had gone. He did not have to search for long. Martin had suspected that Philip would not be far behind him, and he could see Philip flying above the street a few hundred feet down the road, directly behind some sort of commotion. Martin headed that direction and found that he was following a path of mild destruction. Nobody seemed to be hurt, but many of the people he flew over were picking up dropped items or helping fellow pedestrians to their feet. As he gained on the traveling disaster, he saw that it was being caused not by one man running, but by two. The man he was pursuing was still running and looked more panicked than ever. Not far behind, the president's servant was chasing him, gaining ground fast. The man in front was shoving people, grabbing things and throwing them behind him, toppling vendors' carts, anything that might slow the man behind him. The president's servant looked as if he was just out for a casual jog and was dodging various obstacles in order to give his workout some variety. Nothing stopped him or even seemed to slow him down. Martin could see that the president's servant was going to catch the other man. It was just a matter of time. The problem was that in the meantime, a lot of innocent bystanders were going to be inconvenienced, or maybe worse. This guy had tried to kill Britt. Who knew what he might do if he got the upper hand? Either the president's servant would catch the man, or the man would effectively catch himself if they were just patient. Martin, having never been known for his patience, gained altitude and accelerated. He was momentarily distracted by the niggling thought that he hadn't seen a bow, not on the roof, nor now in the fleeing man's hands. He put the thought out of his mind until later, when there would be time to think. Back on street level, the hunted man was frantic. His legs were aching, his throat was closing up, and his breaths were shallow, stabbing barks that were barely bringing in enough oxygen to keep him from blacking out. He wanted to stop running. Each step was more agonizing than the last, but he knew that whatever was going to happen to him if he stopped would be worse. He thought he was in trouble when that foreign sorcerer in the shiny silver robe came after him, but he'd been easy enough to evade. Now, though, he was being chased by this hulking slab of beef with a murderer's eyes and a marathon runner's gait. He fled through the market as quickly as he could. The people milling were doing a pretty good job of parting around him, not because they wanted to assist him in fleeing, but rather because they didn't want to be anywhere near him when he was caught. The man scanned the path in front of him, looking for anything that might slow his pursuer down. He saw a merchant selling heavy woven rugs. As he passed, he grabbed one of the large rolled rugs, a hefty specimen that was taller than himself standing on its side, and he heaved it down in his wake. The gambit cost him most of his momentum, and he struggled to get back up to speed. As he stumbled forward, he turned for a moment, hoping to see the monster chasing him trip and fall, or maybe get knocked off of his feet by the mass of the rug. Instead, what he saw was the man catching the rug and smoothly tossing it aside without ever breaking the rhythm of his stride. Even through his mounting panic, the man had the wherewithal to think, at least he didn't throw it at me. The man turned his attention to the path ahead, just in time to see a silver bolt of light shoot down out of the sky and land directly in his path. It was Martin, who had landed in a crouch and was holding his staff out, parallel with the ground. The man tried to leap over him, like a hurdle, but the force field Martin had just created prevented that. He bounced like a rag doll and would have landed in a miserable heap on the ground if the president's servant hadn't caught him. Instead, he stood, locked in place by the servant's muscular arms. Martin said, "Good work! I'd have lost!" But Martin was stunned into silence when the servant held the man upright with his left hand and brought his right fist down with all of his power onto the man's head. The servant stood a full head taller than the man he'd been chasing, so the blow effectively hit him on the top of the head and caused his knees to buckle beneath him. The servant now held the man's full weight with his left arm, not that it mattered. The servant held him up more solidly than the man's own legs had. The servant drew his right arm back again and hit the man again, this time in the face. He lifted his elbow so that it also hit the man's face as he followed the punch through. Then he backhanded the man as he drew the arm back to punch him again. Martin said, "That's enough!" The servant took no notice. The man's head lolled back sickeningly as the servant struck him in the face again and again. Philip landed next to the servant and yelled, "He's had enough!" He did nothing to stop the servant from hitting the man several more times. He adjusted his grip to hold the man's head upright in a convenient punching position, as clearly the man's neck could no longer do the job on its own. Martin ran forward and stuck his staff between the two men and said, "Muro!" placing a force field between them. The servant still held the man up with one arm, but the other arm couldn't penetrate the barrier to strike him again, instead stopping as if he had punched a wall. Martin said, "Let him go!" The servant kept his grip on the man and felt the force field with his other hand, looking for a hole or a weak spot. Martin noted that for a moment the servant's hand actually left a smear of the other man's blood suspended on the surface of the force field as if it were a sheet of glass. Martin growled,
"I said let him go. He's unconscious. He's not going anywhere. Let him go!"
The servant finished his examination of the force field. He looked at Martin for a moment, smiled, then jerked his left hand in toward his body, smashing the man's face against the other side of the force field. He looked Martin in the eye as he rubbed the man's face into the force field. Then, with a smile aimed at Philip, he released his grip, leaving the man completely without support. With some effort, Martin and Philip caught the man and lowered him gently to the ground. The man had a pulse, but he was out cold, and looking at him, Martin wasn't sure when or even if he would wake up. Martin was dimly aware of the crowd murmuring and receding away from him. He looked up and saw a clear disk slowly descending from the sky, carrying Britt the Younger and Ida. Gwen flew alongside under her own power. The disk hadn't reached the ground before Ida leapt off, shouting,
"Nilo, thank God you're not hurt!"
She ran to her servant and threw her arms around him. Nilo smiled at Martin as he and the president turned and walked away. Gwen looked down at the man lying unconscious and bloody on the ground.
"Is this him?"
she asked. Martin said,
"Yes."
Britt asked,
"What happened to him?"
Martin glanced toward Nilo's retreating form and said,
"He got carried away."
Britt and Gwen exchanged a look that conveyed several emotions. Surprise was not one of them. Britt said,
"We have to get him to a doctor."
And nobody disagreed. Philip and Martin placed the man onto the disk. They all piled onto the disk as well, and at Britt's direction, it rose smoothly into the air. As they flew through the central empty volume of Atlantis, traveling as the crow flies to the nearest doctor, Martin shook his head.
"I don't get it," he said. "This is the guy I chased from the roof, and he was the only one up there. But I thought whoever was trying to kill you was using magic to do it. He's not one of the delegates, and there are no male wizards from Atlantis. Maybe we were wrong about the magic."
Britt said,
"No, we weren't wrong."
Martin asked,
"How do you know?"
Britt frowned and turned to Gwen, saying,
"Go ahead, show them."
Gwen held up the arrow that had been fired at Britt. Gwen held it motionless for a moment, then lightly threw it straight up into the air. It tumbled as it flew upward. Then it straightened and flew, as if pulled by a powerful magnet, directly at Britt. It struck her in the top of the head and stuck there. Britt winced a bit and then pulled the arrow away. Philip said,
"I guess it's a good thing nobody got between you and the arrow."
"Yeah,"
Martin agreed.
"That could have happened really easily, too."
Martin turned to Britt.
"If we don't figure out who keeps trying to kill you soon, someone could get hurt."
Martin grabbed the arrow from Britt's hand and pulled it a foot away, holding it lightly enough that the razor-sharp tip remained pointed directly at Britt, no matter how he moved it. Then he let it go, and it immediately stuck back to Britt. Martin chuckled and said,
"That's really cool."
"Is it?"
Britt asked.
"Is it really?"
Gwen put a reassuring hand on Britt's shoulder, and in a sympathetic voice said,
"It is. Sorry."